Let's pray. As we contemplate Ecclesiastes today, I pray for genuine application to our lives. The truth is sometimes hard to take, and coming face to face with reality doesn't come easy for us. I pray for guidance in my words, and I pray that they're faithful to the text that you've intended, Lord. Amen. So, I've been wanting to go through the book of Ecclesiastes for quite a while, and please find a Bible, if you're able to follow along with me today. I'm planning to go through the entire book in three sermons. That remains to be seen. I will not be doing these three sermons back to back. They'll be spread out over time. It will depend on the schedules of the other elders. But potentially they'll happen before the Christmas season. It will mean having to take a jet tour through it, but I did want to cover it all. The downside to doing it quickly is that I won't have time to cover all the verses in depth. It's unfortunate, but it's the nature of getting all the way through it in a few sermons. It says in the bulletin that I'll be doing chapters 1 through 4. I realized that I was going to end up going too long by taking chapter 4, so I'll just be taking the first three chapters today. Ecclesiastes is similar to the book of Hebrews. The author of Hebrews is written to Hebrew people, but what group he's referring to at any given time determines the context of his thoughts. And Ecclesiastes is similar. Solomon will address stronger believers and weaker ones, wealthy people, poor people, wise people, foolish people, people with the right eternal perspective, people with the wrong eternal perspective, then how to correctly analyze a perspective, then taking a worldly perspective and applying the correct perspective back to it. If that sounds confusing, it can be. Too many commentators that I've listened to have confused what Solomon's trying to say because they're trying to apply a one-dimensional lens to what he says. And some are trying to keep a singular context and theme throughout the book when Solomon changes that multiple times. Make sure you understand this, that you cannot read this book and somehow assume that it's all linear thinking. It is not. Commentators have a wide range of opinions about what Ecclesiastes is saying. Some people say that Solomon's an agnostic, that he doubts God's existence. Others say, no, he's an Orthodox believer. Some say he's a pessimist. Others say he's an optimist. So why does Solomon seem to be embracing both positive and negative positions at the same time? Well, hopefully we'll see that as we go along. Just make sure that every time you quote Ecclesiastes to address something going on in your life, make sure you're using the correct perspective that Solomon uses. It's important to see which part of God's unfolding plan you are engaged in. We should respond to the accurate sense it is presented in and not the circumstances or feelings that go along with it. And so this is my list of categories, or a grid, if you will, that will hopefully bring some clarity on how to evaluate how Solomon is thinking. There are two overarching perspectives that dominate the book. The first is the phrase, under the sun. It's used 28 times. It's the primary position that Solomon operates from. The other perspective is in light of eternity. Now, if only the book was that simple, the under the sun perspective has different viewpoints. There's a worldly under the sun perspective. This worldly under the sun view has two components, the wise version and the foolish version. There's also a practical under the sun perspective, and there's some practical advice here, which, even though it's coming from this worldly perspective, it's just common sense, and therefore it's valuable. There will also be a wise version and a foolish version of being practical. Then there is the in light of eternity perspective. But there's a religious, I know that there's a God, and sure, there's some kind of afterlife perspective. This acknowledges that God exists, but there's no salvation relationship or desire to obey his commandments. But the ultimate perspective that Solomon finally gets to, even though there are hints about it prior, is the God acknowledging eternity is real and that all meaning originates from here. So is Ecclesiastes trying to be pessimistic, optimistic? I think actually the most accurate way to say it is he's trying to be realistic. Solomon doesn't want you to have false expectations about life. This book plumbs the depths of human experience, and in it, Solomon thoroughly examines the emptiness and the futility of a life lived without an eternal perspective. Ecclesiastes infers that nothing has meaning and it's all vanity. Only when you humble yourself at that level do you realize that everything matters and God will bring it all to judgment. Everything, whether it is good or evil. Verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1. With a few exceptions, now I will not be taking the time to read all the verses that I'm covering. I'm assuming that you have it in front of you. I won't read the verses purely for the sake of time, so please get a Bible and follow along as we go. I've heard it said that Ecclesiastes is 11 and a half chapters of hopeless despair, and the answer or the remedy comes in the last half of chapter 12. It's a bit of an oversimplification, but the good news is there are real nuggets of application hidden in the despair. Solomon appeals to universally acceptable arguments and realities that even an unbeliever will recognize. Verse 2, he comes up with his first conclusion. Now, this is not the final conclusion, that's at the end, but this is the first one. Not only is life vanity, but all is vanity. There is nothing that you can get your hands on. There's nothing there. It's all unreliable, frail, short, of no effect. Vanity of vanities means the ultimate. It's the all-inclusive, and he's saying it as strong as you can possibly say it. Plus, it gets repeated for further emphasis. Not only is life vanity, but all is vanity. So we think our life has meaning, and in a certain sense, it does. In different contexts, it does. But from the worldly perspective of the book of Ecclesiastes, it's meaningless. In a different sense, outside the book, it's not meaningless. But from the point of view of Solomon in this overall context, it is. One of the premier points being made in Ecclesiastes is not simply that there is a God, but we answer to him in eternity. And it could be said that anyone can go through the Bible and find the meaning of life wherever you turn. Verse 3, what is your labor worth? As I stated previously, under the sun is used 28 times. It is life considered without an eternal perspective. With eternity out of the picture, what was all your labor worth? Nothing. Solomon is set to undo what your idea of the meaning of life is. Verses 4 through 7. This is the idea that nothing much changes in God's created order. God's creation is dependable. It's been said in the past, there are two dependable pieces of furniture in your life, the cradle and the coffin. These unchanging cycles highlight the unchanging monotony of life. Now, in our modern age, we seem to be numb to this. It's probably a safe bet that technology is responsible for us not coming to grips with this. Technology gives the illusion of newness. It's fresh, it's unexplored. However, it's also a tool that directs your mind away from the realities of life. If you're a hamster on a wheel, you can run faster and faster, but then where do you go? You go nowhere. And you can think, wow, this is new, this is novel, this is great, but it changes nothing. Every innovation that man comes up with today is just a rehashing of a reality that has already existed in the past. In the Old Testament, it sings God's praises concerning his creation. Solomon says, if you take away God, take away all his eternal creation and governing of all things, then his creation no longer reflects his glory. Verses 8 through 11. Solomon says it's not only reflected in nature. That is the repetitive cycle, but it's also evidenced in human effort and endeavor. So despite all a man's effort, his work, toiling, all of his seeing and hearing, he is still not satisfied. Haven't you ever done any self-introspection and realized that there has to be something more? There have to be things that I don't know about. Is it all more than just your life? Solomon finally figured this out. None of the trappings of the earth are satisfying. And the older you get, the more you will realize that that is true. Verses 9 to 10. So I'm sure most of you have heard the phrase, it is what it is. It's actually a biblical phrase, and here it is in verse 9. Now, it's very important how you use this phrase because I got it wrong for a long time. If you say it is what it is and you mean it doesn't matter what happens, whatever will be, eat, drink, and be merry, and then you die, that is Solomon's approach here. There's nothing positive about using it that way. A Christian should never use it in this way. But if you say God is on his throne, he's in control, and you view life with a God-centered life in view of eternity, then your it is what it is has meaning. With all of life's work and progress, life seems monotonously the same. Have you ever heard someone say, and especially younger people, I'm bored? That void cannot be filled with any technology, achievements, or satisfactions of this world. God has put an empty space in our hearts that can only be filled with him. But it's not just him, but him in eternity. That is the definition of hope. Hope is always tied to eternity. Anything new becomes old very quickly because there's nothing new under the sun. Is God a liar when he proclaims that? The old ways go on, and we run a race that we never seem to learn as we go. Verse 11. We have a hard time learning from history. The futility of life works in both directions. We don't learn from the past, and we think the future will break all the molds and everything will be different. It's shocking how soon people forget about you when you're gone. Whether you're displaced or you die, you're quickly forgotten. Now, not trying to be insensitive here. It's nothing personal at all, but is the nature of how life is. Solomon highlights that. And so as he's unfolded the meaning and meaninglessness so far, you might conclude that this is the way that it's supposed to be. He says, no, it's supposed to be different than this. So Solomon says, I'm going to investigate this, and I'm going to try and find the meaning of life under the sun. Under the sun doesn't mean without God, but without a God that matters. Verse 12, Solomon was known far and wide for his great wisdom. If things were able to be found and ascertained through wisdom, Solomon was the guy to find them. On top of that, Solomon's great wisdom was a gift of God. So here's a guy who's super qualified and gifted, and he's going to set out and try and find the meaning of life through all that can be tried under heaven. Verses 13 and 14. Solomon was looking for answers through wisdom, and by that he meant human wisdom. That means there were answers that were excluded in light of eternity. So he's going to search high and low for this human wisdom. He looks at it generally and specifically. Now, you must realize that there's a certain value in some forms of human wisdom. Wisdom in all forms has some level of value. Many lives would be better off following this direction, but this will not answer the question of the meaninglessness of life. It has no true answers. It only shows you how to live your meaningless life a little better. Understand what verse 13 is telling us. This seemingly futile life comes from God. God has given us the sense that we realize there's an eternity void, but he's also given us the ability and desire to search it out. God deliberately built a life system where life seems meaningless without the understanding of a living, active God to whom we must give an account. Is it cruel of God to devise a system like that? On the contrary, it's evidence of his great love and mercy. Our hearts are restless until we find our home in him. It's a burdensome task to find these things out. Our pride, our self-love, and our self-reliance all work against God's path to find true meaning in our life. Most people run into everyday life, their lives, as if God doesn't matter. It doesn't mean they don't know he exists, but they live independent of his influence. And Ecclesiastes is written through the eyes of a man who would think that way. Verse 15, the preacher's initial search for wisdom under the sun only brought him despair. Solomon is just a little too honest with us because he's very quick to tell us the results of his search. After exhaustive effort to try and find the meaning and fulfillment under the sun, he has zero success. What is crooked can't be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. What's wrong can never be set right. Do we understand that? What God has set in place to fit his purposes can never and should never be altered. The things that are wrong are so great that they can't be numbered. Solomon gathers himself. There must be more, he thinks. There must be a solution. Verse 16, It's natural for anyone under the sun to look to their heart and mind for answers. We look inward for direction and guidance instead of to God, who rules eternity. So how do you decide what is right and what is wrong? Do you let yourself be the guide? That is vanity. It's chasing after the wind. Have you ever stopped and just contemplated how dumb it is to chase after the wind? Verses 17 and 18. It didn't take Solomon long to figure this out. Searching harder and increasing the effort produced madness. The more you understand life under the sun, the greater will be your despair. The question is, where do you put that despair? The more you know, the more you understand life's sorrows. With no eternal perspective, you've fallen into a hole you can't ever climb out of. Your only option is to live a seemingly better, meaningless life. The more you come to realize the truth of what Solomon is saying, the more reality settles into your mind. The more you see life for what it is without an eternal perspective, and the more pain and grief you will see. Even from a Christian point of view, this is true. The more you embrace Solomon's realizations, the more you can see the grief coming. You know there is pain around the corner. So what is the buffer for that? The buffer is God's peace and hope. Peace through him and hope in him. Godly wisdom will not prevent tragedy, but it won't let you be blindsided by it all. In that sense, we don't live under the sun. Christians have new things that aren't part of being relegated under the sun. In Christ, we get new things like a new nature. Hebrews 10:20 says that we have a new and living way to heaven. We are new creations in him. Solomon is setting us up to find newness in the midst of vanity and striving. All that newness is in Christ. Solomon is going to destroy any illusion you may have that is apart from eternity with God. I hope some of this is hitting close to home. Chapter 2. Don't forget that this one phrase speaks to the primary context of Ecclesiastes, under the sun. The consideration is, what would the world be like if this is all there is? What does it mean and how should we live? Verse 1. Solomon hits another angle of dealing with life apart from eternity. Earthly wisdom was his previous target. Now he's going to focus on pleasure and amusement. And isn't that the area where many people are seeking fulfillment today? Earthly wisdom, well, Solomon is going to test that theory of pleasure seeking. Barely has the proposition left his mouth, and we already have the answer. It's futility. It's vanity. Entertainment is smashed flat before he even tries to explain. Verses 2 and 3. What are the results? Laughter? Madness. Pleasure? What's the point of it? Like a modern celebrity, he went from party to party. He tried wine, even under wise use of it. This won't be the evaluation of a young person who hasn't lived long enough to see the folly that Solomon brings up. It's after much evaluation and experience did he finally see the light at the end of the tunnel. But then he did see it. Wine and alcohol was a failure. And somebody might say, well, I never overindulge. Maybe not, but there's a fine line between very casual use and what can turn destructive. Because Solomon said he used it wisely. But did it bring him any fulfillment? Did he have anything good to say about it after all of his evaluation? All the effort became real to him after the failure in his seeking. So name the vice, and it may not be the thing that causes you to die, but it will be part of the chasing after the wind which leaves a void in your life. After enough vanity, enough futility, you look in the mirror and say, what happened to my life? Solomon had to check the avenues to see what would happen if this is all there is. So he's not talking about a quick fix or a diversion, but will this give meaning to my life? Verses 4 through 8. He wasn't just seeking after amusements, but elevated accomplishments. Building, organizing, improving his environment, hard work, investing, riches. Solomon had a well-oiled machine. Verses 9 to 11. Solomon realized that all his wealth lifted him to another level above everyone in his town. He attained that level by being wise, not by deception. But by the same token, there were no limits to his lusting for wealth and power. He became great in this process. He became famous. Isn't that what some people think will give meaning to their life? Achieving fame must put you in the upper echelons of gaining meaning. It means something when the wealthiest man pulls out all the stops and everything at his disposal to gain meaning. And because he had unfettered access to everything, there were no roadblocks for him that the average person would run into. And his heart was pleased and satisfied in all this because it was not dishonest gain. It was legitimate for the labor he put forth. So it seems to be wise to go down that path. His conclusion? Vanity, striving after the wind, no profit under the sun. Verses 12 to 17. You can have a legitimate pleasure that has a monetary payoff. There are also illegitimate pleasures that come with a future price tag. This section tells us that even the good and legitimate pleasures of life ultimately have no meaning in an under-the-sun world. The answer to why they have no meaning is because you die. You don't take any of it with you. He took a step back to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, and even a king who can accomplish far more than the average person faces the same problem. Solomon came after his father David, the king. Solomon knew his father died. He knew he was going to die, and his sons would die after him. So even for a king, there was nothing new under the sun. Then there's an obvious conclusion. It's far better to be wise than to be a fool. And so this is some of the tension in Ecclesiastes, where wisdom can be the ultimate prize and yet worthless at the same time. But guess what? The same event happens to the wise and the foolish. Death. Death ultimately makes all things meaningless. Then Solomon comes to the realization that all my wisdom meant nothing. It's all vanity. But don't forget the context. The context for Solomon is the lens through which there is an eternity without God. The wise man and the fool both die. Then the monotony of life causes us all to forget the past. We must concern ourselves with what's happening now and what is around the corner, the past is soon forgotten. But then Solomon exhibits anger. It's unfair that all this is meaningless. He thinks, I want to be in control of the outcome. My self-reliance should have counted for something. Verses 18 to 23. The preacher just didn't hate all the effort and the striving, but he ended up hating all that he had accomplished. Why? Because you end up passing it on to the people who come after you. I did all the work and they end up with all the fruits of my labor. This person could be wise to take care of it all, or they could be a fool and squander it. Solomon, in all his wisdom and toil, ended up leaving his worth to his son, Rehoboam. Solomon must have grieved over the fact that he had 700 wives, 300 concubines, and he ended up leaving his wealth to a fool. It's all meaningless. Leaving my labor to someone who contributed nothing. It's vanity. Solomon despaired over how death makes it all meaningless. That led to days of being oppressed by those thoughts and many a sleepless night. All vanity. But he goes beyond that here, because beyond vanity, it's a great evil. And so it's pretty easy to get depressed at this point. Why does this bother us? Let's say you're living out an under-the-sun world premise. Let's say you believe in materialistic evolution, that God has nothing to do with creation. We're all here by accident. There's no meaning to life. You simply go out of existence when you die. Then why would someone be bothered by any of this? Why does it cause discontent if there's no eternity? Because the fact is, we are all designed for eternity, whether we acknowledge it or not. Verses 24 and 25. So here he shifts gears a little bit. He's now going to talk about how to live life under the sun. He says to eat, drink, live out your life, enjoy life's basic blessings. This idea gets repeated about five times in Ecclesiastes. It seems that Solomon's teaching us how to make the best out of a bad situation, since it's all meaningless, and have a good time because you're going to die anyway. God designed it this way. Whatever will be, will be. Is that what he's saying? It's not, because this thinking doesn't give you true meaning to a life headed for eternity. All that thinking can get you is a path to collapse into fatalism. G. Campbell Morgan said that materialism necessarily becomes fatalism. Then Solomon knows that he is, by God's grace, gifted far above most people and able to enjoy all these pleasures way more than they. But by our exterior measurement, we see people who have it all. We can get jealous of them. We want to have what they have, but they're not living their life for eternal meaning. Their life has no meaning. That materialistic life under the sun is infinitely poorer than the simplest man or woman who has true eternal meaning to their life. These enjoyments come from God through the work that he gives us. Verse 26, for to the person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy. It gets repeated often in Ecclesiastes that if you're a child of God, do not forget that these blessings originate with God. He supplies all these. And in the under-the-sun perspective, sometimes what the sinner has gathered and collected, in spite of their relationship with God, is ultimately unfair. That injustice that works in someone's favor is still vanity, grasping for the wind. But in light of eternity, the Lord uses your toil. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 8. Now, this is a beautifully written section here. This is one that most people are familiar with, describing all the facets of life. There's a time for everything. But if you look over these 9 verses here at the beginning, time to tear down, a time to build up, time to weep, time to throw stones. I personally think Solomon may have written this when he was in the process of cleaning out his garage. It's funnier if you're actually going through that process right now. The problem is, too many people read this simplistically. Or another temptation is to read it sentimentally. There are all these seasons of life, but you can't take these poetic parallels without embracing the context that follows them. Now, these are all pairs of opposites, and even though Solomon is using opposites that are at the opposing sides of the spectrum, he's assuming everything in between. There will be times of joy and good fortune, but you don't determine when they will be. There will be times of sorrow and heartache, but you won't be the one to pick those either. Even death, God does not inquire of our schedule to see if it fits in. Solomon becomes more reflective here than he was in the first 2 chapters. There's a beautiful, predictable flow of life, and it also casts a very dark shadow, and that's because it reminds us of the inevitability of trouble and evil, the relentless monotony of life. And there's also a sense that he highlights time as a grasping at the wind. You try and grab hold of it, filters through your fingers like sand. And it clearly identifies for us that there's a time and a place for everything. Randomness does not exist in God's world. Everything will come to pass exactly as he drew it up. Unstoppable seasons bring a level of predictability, but also a level of despair, as repetition can be depressing. We can look at it as being a slave to our calendar. Not a great feeling, is it? Trust me, I know this. There's always a sense of helplessness. Time controls you. Grasping after the wind, it's the perfect metaphor. The fact is, man cannot master time. We do not control the timing of events or circumstances in our lives. We're at the mercy of time. It's our task to skillfully navigate through difficult times and honor God in the process rather than trying to overcome who is the master of the clock. Every fiber in our body wants to overcome time and the timing of things. We want to respond to events and how things unfold. The way we respond is a gospel issue. Our response to situations in our lives is very important to God. How we walk through what we would have never chosen to happen means something to him. Solomon actually had a number one hit song in the U.S. about this. It's called Turn, Turn, Turn by the Byrds in 1965. And it was about this section of scripture. Unfortunately, I don't think that Solomon received any songwriting credit or any royalties, but he should have. Verse 2, it's important to see the beginning of this song. It's not instructional, it's observational. Birth and death, the boundaries of life under the sun. Then we go through all the contrasting positive things versus the negative things. Solomon figured out that even though there are good things in life, bad things can't be escaped. All the good and the beautiful things are going to be offset by something negative. Verses 9 through 11. Now we get Solomon's expansion of the poem or the song that we just went through. Solomon asks a question he asked before, but this time there's an answer. If you believe that God has a purpose for you to fulfill things for you to do, there's meaning in that. Everything that God made is glorious in its season. So when everything is messed up, when everything goes wrong, when everything we don't want to happen is happening, our thought process is, I wish this was like a previous season when it worked out differently. It is at that point that we should have memorized chapter 3, verse 11. Say to yourself that God has made everything beautiful in its time. One thing you should keep in mind is how you read through the book. It shouldn't be a good mood, bad mood, worst case scenario, taking things in stride. God alone sees the finished work of creation. We insist on seeing it, but we can't. You will become dissatisfied, discontent, and lack peace when you're not content with the work that God has given you in this season. In Romans, God declared that the knowledge of himself and his law have been written on man's heart. As a human created in his image, believer or unbeliever, you know that there is eternity beyond the grave. And yet, God has not revealed much of his eternal work to us. It keeps the yearning for eternity alive in our hearts. Verses 12 and 13. Jared asked me a couple weeks ago, why did you choose Ecclesiastes?